of dignity, of prestige, of gray, impressive stone. But what he said was, "Oh, of all the things." And she wondered if this was a specific response to the name, or simply an arbitrary outburst, evidence of the way his temper had been flaring recently at odd, unpredictable moments. Phrases like that one had become a catch-all for him when he couldn't muster a more appropriate response. "For heaven's sake, good heavens, I'll be damned." It reminded her of the way Elixir had been given a set of responses to use when nothing else was available. David reverted to them frequently by then, and when he uttered them, she read in his eyes a certain disappointment that he could not conjure up a more precise choice of words. Volley quickly back the best response. Finding the mot juste had been a skill on which he had prided himself for as long as Ada could remember. Before the illness, he had loathed puns and loved cleverness in equal measure. Words to David were nearly mathematical. There was very clearly a correct one for every slot in every sentence. When he was at his sharpest, he rolled them into place like a putter on a green. Now a good day meant that he could come up with a dozen in a row that were appropriate to the situation at hand. In the front seat, Liston was making small talk. She feigned cheerfulness for David's sake, to keep him settled, but she glanced at Ada in the rearview mirror every few moments, and Ada looked out the window. Liston had told her again and again that this was the best thing for David, that he couldn't be cared for safely at home, not anymore. But since the decision had been made for him to go to St. Andrews, Ada had been envisioning, almost obsessively, other lives, other plans, for herself and her father. She daydreamed often about running away with him, to New York City, to a different country, to the cabin in the woods of the Adirondacks that David had rented for years. Conveniently, these daydreams simultaneously allowed her to envision leaving behind her education at Queen of Angels as well. And when she was not daydreaming, she was paying extra attention to David's mannerisms, his appearance, his gait. She wanted to memorize them. With the little camera she rarely used, she had recently been taking photographs of him, surreptitiously, in different places in the house. Later, these would look to her like pictures of a ghost. In them, he was expressionless. Gone were David's funny, theatrical, changing features. In their place was the lion face she had read about in articles, a term that frightened her with its implication of cruelty, its implication that the bearer of such a countenance might suddenly eat her alive. Instead, she tried to think of David's face as a doll's face, a still and quiet mask. Liston turned right at a sign that bore the name of the facility in an even font that reminded her of the lettering on banks. St. Andrew's Manor, established 1951. At the top of a small hill sat several low brick buildings in the shape of a U. Liston pulled her car into the parking lot, and Ada saw the figures of David's left hand curl into a fist. She leaned forward to take in the view. Two old women, much older than David, sat in wheelchairs on the paved driveway that abutted the front entrance. They were slumped in their chairs. One seemed asleep, her head lolling forward on her chest. The other moved her feet back and forth slowly, as if trying to get up and walk. The three of them got out of the car, David only after Liston's prompting. He was relatively able-bodied still, and he got up quickly from his seat and closed the door behind him in one easy motion. There was a plaque to the right of the front door that identified Andrew as the patron saint of fishermen. And once Ada got inside, she saw why the place was named for him. The large rear windows of the lobby looked east to the harbor some distance away, visible from the building only by virtue of the elevation of its plot of land. Still, Ada could see boats there, sailing inland and out, and it was a sunny day, which made everything seem a little less dismal. The rest of the lobby was drab and beige, with floral patterns on the pillows, with arrangements of armchairs and tables and books she was certain no one ever looked at, and two fireplaces that looked similarly untouched. They might not even work, she thought, and she wished that they did. David's love of fireplaces was well known to everyone who knew him. David stood and looked at the ocean while Liston navigated the front desk. Ada was grateful for her doing this so that she didn't have to. She had a speech prepared to make to the administration and staff about David's needs and concerns, but it had gone out of her head, and she stood with David and stared. In a moment of self-awareness, she closed her jaw. He seemed too young to be in this place, she thought. Who would he talk to? She vowed to visit him every day, taking two buses from Dorchester to Quincy. After a moment, two administrators emerged from a hallway, one a Carmelite nun.
How are you, sister? Said Liston cheerily.
It was clear from the nun's response that she remembered Liston from her mother's time in residence. As she introduced herself, Ada was uncertain about whether to shake her hand. She had not shaken the hands of any of the nuns who taught her upon meeting them, but this one offered hers to Ada kindly, and she took it very gently, ignoring the admonitions David had always given her about being firm and businesslike when she gripped anybody's hand in greeting. She was younger than Ada had thought most nuns to be. She must have been very young indeed the last time Liston had seen her, and she said her name was Sister Catherine. The other administrator was Patrick Rowan, a middle-aged man with stale breath and a wide blue tie. Ada immediately disliked him for the way he took David's hand with one of his and put an arm behind David's back, as if David were incapable of walking, as if he needed anyone else to navigate him in this way. David, too, recoiled.
Oh, for heaven's sake, said David. What a production.
And Ada felt warm with satisfaction that he had produced such an appropriate response. Their little group walked down the hallway toward a wing called the Mount Carmel Center for Memory Care and stopped outside a set of double doors. Patrick Rowan punched in a code and the doors swung open. As Ada walked through them, she turned back over her shoulder and noticed an identical keypad on the opposite side. Clearly, there was no leaving this wing without the password. After several turns that left her feeling disoriented, she came to David's room. On the wall outside, it was a placard with two paper cards slid into it. One that said, Mr. David Sebelius. Doctor, Ada thought to herself, not Mr. And one that said, Mr. John Gaynor. Inside, she saw that David's roommate was ancient. To her, he looked 100 or more. Though later, as an adult, she realized he had probably been closer to 85. He said nothing to them as they entered. He was a small man, sitting in a recliner that cradled him like a hammock, his back bowed, his little neat feet sticking up at the end, an enormous magnifying glass in one hand, looking through it at a book that he did not lower as their party of five entered the room.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gaynor, said Patrick Rowan loudly.
And then he turned to Ada and said in a normal voice,
Mr. Gaynor can't hear much.
He brought David toward Mr. Gaynor and bent down, placing a hand on his shoulder.
This is David Sebelius, said Patrick Rowan. Your new roommate.
How do you do? Said Mr. Gaynor.
And David nodded formally. The room was large and decorated sparsely. A brown wooden crucifix, like the ones at Queen of Angels, hung above the door on the inside wall. Ada wondered if it was David's roommate's or a standard part of the decor in every room. The two twin beds were on opposite walls, and on Mr. Gaynor's bed there was a blue crocheted blanket that somebody, his wife? Ada wondered, had made for him. There were two matching recliners that looked quite comfortable, and two wooden-backed chairs, two dressers, two nightstands,
two bookshelves mounted to the walls above the beds, too small for the collection of books still sitting in Liston's car. Not that David read much anymore. But Ada had imagined that to have his favorites with him would be comforting, like the photographs of her and their friends that Liston had brought along. Disappointingly, the large window opposite the door looked out at the parking lot. She wished he had a harbor view. The ceiling was made of large panels that looked to her like styrofoam. She had the impression that they could be taken out quite easily from movies she'd seen involving heists. Briefly, her mind wandered once more to absconding with David. The floor was blue vinyl. The overheads were painfully fluorescent, a type of light that David despised and found depressing. He had commented on it all his life, whenever they found themselves in restaurants or stores where they were employed. "If only they'd do something about the lights, though," he had lamented in certain locations in the past. He had even coaxed Tran into using incandescent light bulbs several years ago, offering to pay for them himself. Now he was looking around his new room. He circled it once, slowly. He opened up a small drawer in the nightstand. Into it, he put his lucky clover charm. He closed the drawer again. He offered up a closed smile. "I'll be darned," he said, as Sister Catherine moved about the room, smoothing the tightly made white bed, fluffing the pillows. "Now, Ada," she said, "I'm going to write down David's direct line for you, all right? This is his phone number," she said. "You can reach him anytime. And David, you can call Ada anytime, too. We can help you." She took a small pad of paper out of the breast pocket of her large dark blazer, and after writing on it, ripped off a piece of it and handed it to Ada. David smiled faintly. "Our residents are very happy here," she said. Ada believed that she believed this. "Isn't that right, Mr. Gaynor?" she asked, raising her voice, but Mr. Gaynor had already gone back to his book, and he did not know he was being addressed. "I know Mom was," said Liston politely. Liston sat with David on the edge of his bed while Ada ran back and forth to the car, unloading his possessions with the help of a metal dolly that Patrick Rowan had found for her. When she had everything set up, she asked him if he'd like anything moved. Slowly, he looked about the room. He walked to the bedside table and touched one of the photographs that Liston had framed. It was a shot of the group of them, the Steiner lab, leaning forward over a dinner table at a restaurant that Ada could no longer remember the name of. It had been taken perhaps 4 years prior. Ada looked noticeably younger and smaller in it, and Liston's hair was a slightly different shade of red. David, as usual, was missing from the shot. He'd been the photographer. The restaurant, a Thai place they had gone to only once or twice, had since closed. Ada had liked it. They all ate shoeless, sitting on the floor, their feet in a little sunken pit below the table, and her chicken and cashews had come served in half of a hollowed-out pineapple. "They probably reused that time after time," Liston had said, horrified. But Ada and David had not cared. This was the picture David lifted now from the table. "Amarind," he said suddenly. "The name of the restaurant." And Ada wondered if they had made a mistake admitting him here. They stayed with him through lunch, and Liston tried to make friends on his behalf. She charmed the staff, one of whom, a woman named Peggy, had grown up next door to her in Dorchester. Some of the others she knew as well. "Oh, she's terrible," she whispered to Ada, upon seeing a tall, thin, spectral woman at the end of a hallway, and she turned them all abruptly in the opposite direction. She waved to the other residents, asked them their names, introduced David to them as they all walked by. Ada did not want to admit it to anyone, not even herself, but she was frightened being there. The old people around her frightened her. Some of them were slumped in their wheelchairs, tilted, askew. Later in her life, she would seek out the presence of older people, find them comforting, find peace near them. But now she avoided their gaze. It could not be comfortable, she thought, for some of them to be alive. One of them approached her too quickly, called her by the wrong name.
"There she is," said the old lady. "Oh, Patty, I didn't know where you'd gone."
Ada walked by her, facing forward, and said nothing. She realized that David had said such things, was capable of saying such things. But he was familiar to her, at least. She had watched his slow progression. In him, she could still see some essential Davidness, and still, in most ways, take comfort in it. After lunch, they walked him back to the common area adjacent to the dining room, where Mr. Gaynor was seated at a card table, staring at a puzzle that had already been completed.
"Why don't we sit here for a while?" said Liston, and she perched on the arm of a floral sofa while Ada and David sat in it and made cheery conversation with the two of them and with everyone else in the room.
"This was my mother's favorite place to sit in the evenings before dinner," said Liston.
And just for a moment, through Ada's own sadness, she recognized the sadness of Liston, the pain that she must have felt at the loss of her mother. It was something she had never truly considered about adults. She had always somehow imagined that the loss of a loved one would hurt less for them, that it would feel like something natural, that they would be calm and practiced and dulled to death. In fact, she was counting on it, for she had been telling herself that if only David would hold on to life for the next decade, by the time she was 24, she would be better equipped to handle his absence. But something in Liston's voice, as she spoke of her mother, made Ada realize that she had been incorrect in this assumption. 20 or 30 minutes passed by, and then Liston looked at her watch. They had been there for nearly 6 hours, and Ada knew that she would want to get home for Maddie.
"It's time for us to go, David," said Ada, so that Liston would not have to.
He nodded slowly. They walked him back to his room, and then he sat down stiffly on his bed, his hands on his knees. He looked too thin. He did not look at her. A flash of anger overcame her suddenly, at the unfairness of it all. He was not like the rest of them, she thought. He could not possibly belong here, in this place, full of the dying, the near dead. "Snap out of it," she wanted to tell him. "Wake up."
"I'll see you tomorrow," said Ada instead.
And as she left him, walking slowly down the hallway, she willed herself not to look back. She thought of the story of Lot's wife, and of David's voice as he had told it to her many years ago. In honor of Ada's first evening as a member of the Liston household, the head of it had planned a family dinner. She had commanded her boys to be there and invited her daughter Joni, too.
"I'll be right back," said Ada, when they pulled onto Shawmut Way. And then she returned briefly to David's house to gather together a few more things before moving, permanently, to Liston's.
Just as she had done a year ago, the first time David disappeared, Ada packed some clothes and books into a little suitcase, and then for a moment she paused and sat down briefly on her bed. She looked around the hot, close room that had been hers since she could remember. It was an eaved chamber with a half-high closet, in which hung the few items of clothing she presently owned, each of which David had bought for her, whenever he had thought of it, or whenever he had been reminded to by Liston, and some from the past that she was particularly fond of. The dirndl he had purchased for her in Munich, which she had long since outgrown. A little pair of Dutch wooden shoes, hand-painted with tulips. A beautiful silk kimono, purchased in Kyoto. She went through all of these now, tenderly, remembering each trip, forcing herself to consider the idea that she would not ever take a trip with David again.
Then she folded the several shirts she had that currently fit her, and her one pair of jeans, and underwear and socks, and the several training bras that Liston had taken her to buy 2 years ago, stealing her away from the lab for the afternoon.
"Tell your father if you want to," Liston had said. "He won't care."
And he wouldn't have. But Ada didn't, telling herself, out of embarrassment, that it was not necessary. They didn't fit her properly anymore. She would have to work up her courage either to tell Liston or to venture into a department store by herself. All of these items she packed into her little blue suitcase. Its faded leather had reminded her, always, of the skin of an elephant, an observation that had once made David laugh aloud. Then, at last, Ada walked down the wide wooden staircase that took her to the first floor, bearing her suitcase bravely in her left hand and hanging on to the banister with her right. How many times had she walked down this staircase in anticipation of some new discovery, some new lesson that would be imparted to her by her father, her creator, some conversation that would open before her a new dimension of the universe, a new chapter of the history of the world. Ada was relieved to find, upon entering Liston's house, that her sons were nowhere to be found. Dinner was planned for 6:30.
"Everyone's out," said Liston, "but they'll be back soon. They'd better be anyway."
Then she showed her up to her new room, Maddie's old one, which in the last week Liston had stripped of its boyishness and made as plain as she could. Maddie had now been given permanent residency in Gregory's room. Ada shuddered to think how Gregory might have reacted to this change, and the race car bed had been moved with him. A twin bed with a dust ruffle and a pink and orange afghan, Joni's when she was small, said Liston, had replaced it. A small pupil's desk with a lid that opened upward was pushed against a windowed wall, and a pine dresser, emptied, had been positioned near the closet. On the floor was a carpet with a somewhat psychedelic pattern of neon flowers, poppies, she thought, that Liston proudly said she had found at the Salvation Army, her favorite place to shop.
"Will you be okay in here, honey?"
asked Liston, and Ada nodded brightly, although she already missed the quietness, the warmth, the dusty, uncomfortable heat of her old bedroom. In here, the air conditioning that Liston had insisted on was turned up too high for Ada's liking, and she put on a sweater as soon as Liston had left. From the first floor, faint sounds made their way up the stairs. The television, pots and pans clanking in the kitchen, Liston letting out one loud yell when something went awry. The kitchen door as it opened and closed. A female voice Ada recognized as Joni's and the babyish exclamations of her son, Kenny. And then finally, a low male voice that made the blood speed up in Ada's veins. She opened her suitcase, considered what to wear. The jeans she had, she decided, would have to do, although they were unfashionable. Too stiff, too large, much darker than the acid-washed versions that were in style then. These she paired with a large purple t-shirt. Purple, she had once furtively read in a women's magazine in a waiting room, brought out the color of brown eyes. And leather sandals, the same unisex kind that David wore himself. For the first time, she rolled the sleeves of her t-shirt up, a style she had seen other children wear, and then she braided her hair. In the mirror, she took her glasses off, and then put them back on. She wished she had pierced ears. At 6:25, descending the stairs, Ada felt nervous in a way she had rarely felt in her lifetime. Despite her geographic proximity to them, despite the fact that during her year-long tenure at Queen of Angels, she had regularly glimpsed all three boys in the hallways and outside, Gregory with his head down, glancing up furtively from beneath lowered eyebrows, William with his head tossed back in laughter or in pride. Despite the fact that she had bravely held up her hand to them in greeting each time she had seen any of them, this would be the first real meal she had ever shared with all of the Listons. Liston had set places at the dining room table in a way that reminded Ada of the dinner parties David used to have. Maddie was seated already, eagerly holding upright his knife and fork on either side of his plate. Gregory was next to him.
"Hi,"
said Maddie, and Gregory said nothing.
"Hi,"
said Ada softly.
"Are you here, Ada?"
Liston called out from the kitchen.
"Oh, good. Come in here for a sec."
Timidly, Ada walked around the corner into the kitchen, where the faint smell of something burning was masked by the scent of onions simmering in a pan. The baby was playing on the floor on a blanket. Joni, plump and blonde and smiling, a larger and younger version of Liston, was standing above him, watching her mother cook. And William Liston was leaning against a counter, a can of Coke in his hand.
"Hey," he said to Ada as she walked in,
and she managed to reply.
"You remember Joni, honey, right?"
said Liston, who was stirring frantically, barely pausing to turn around.
"Dinner's just going to be the tiniest bit late," she said.
At the table, Liston lit a candle, the way that David always did.
"Fancy,"
said William, and Liston frowned at him. Ada was sitting on the same side as Maddie and Gregory. Across from her were William and Joni and Kenny. Liston sat at the head. Liston held up a large glass of the artificially sweetened iced tea she drank as part of her ongoing attempt to lose weight, and said,
"Honey, we are so happy to have you here."
Dinner, spaghetti and meatballs, boiled frozen peas cooked slightly too long, with two pats of butter on the top. Boiled frozen carrots, similarly prepared, was passed around the table. Ada was not hungry. Her nervousness made it nearly impossible to finish even a few small bites, and she twirled and twirled the pasta on her plate, moving it this way and that. The boys and Joni talked over one another raucously, except for quiet Gregory, who sat and ate his meal dourly, sitting very still. The baby, Kenny, squawked and patted his spaghetti with an open palm until Joni grabbed his hand and said, "No," at which point he dissolved into hurt tears. The noise, the volume of it, the disarray of five children at a table, Ada included herself in this figure somewhat tentatively, were a shock to her. She fought against her instinct, which was to put both hands over both ears and hide beneath the table. Liston happily presided over everyone.
"This is really nice," she said twice. "Don't you think, guys? We should do this more often," she mused.
Frequently, though briefly, Ada glanced at William, who slouched in his chair and held his fork with his fist. He looked back at her curiously several times and once asked her about one of her teachers at Queen of Angels, and she managed a reply, lighthearted enough to satisfy herself. Toward the end of the meal, Liston told Ada to wait where she was and went into the other room. She brought back with her something clumsily gift-wrapped, an amorphous object concealed behind wrapping paper covered in balloons.
"A little welcome present," said Liston.
When Ada opened it, she saw it was a backpack, a simple blue one, exactly the kind she would have chosen if she'd had the chance. It was the kind her classmates owned. It was inconspicuous. It was perfect.
"I've seen you carrying all those books to school in your arms," said Liston, "out the window, you poor thing."
"Thank you so much," said Ada,
with as much sincerity as she could muster. But although she was indeed grateful to have it, this token that indicated in some fundamental way that she belonged among her peers, she also sensed the loss of something. Her father's difference. Her own. When the dinner was over, Ada returned to her new bedroom and thought of David in his new bedroom, sharing a room with Mr. Gaynor, who probably would not even speak to him. She wondered about the state of his mind that night, wondered what he realized, what confused him. He had to feel disoriented, she thought, in his new home, with its linoleum floors and its terrible fluorescent lights. Suddenly, she remembered the piece of paper Sister Catherine had handed her with David's direct line on it. She opened her suitcase and fished in it for the shorts she had been wearing earlier, and from them she pulled David's number. There was no telephone in Ada's room, but she put her head out into the hallway, and finding it empty, picked up the extension on a nearby table, and dialed. It was 9 o'clock. Not too late to call, she hoped. The phone rang 5 times. She began to be worried. And then, at last, someone answered.
Hello?
Said David. He sounded worried. He sounded unlike himself. David, she said. It's me. A pause. Are you okay? She asked. Is everything okay there? She was speaking quietly to avoid being overheard by any of the Listens. Still, he said nothing. David? Said Ada. And then, impulsively, she tried a word she had never used before. Dad?
I'm sorry, said David. I don't know who this is, he said.
And then he hung up the phone. The following week, Liston put David's house on the market, where it would stay, she told Ada, for months, perhaps years. It was the 1980s, and houses in Dorchester were slow to sell, even in Savin Hill. The busing controversy of the previous decade had quieted, but it had brought to the surface such unspeakable ugliness and hatred that the city felt somehow altered in its wake. Boston's molecules had reorganized themselves in a way that felt noticeable and raw. Many of its citizens, mainly working-class and middle-class Bostonians of Irish and Italian descent, had left for the towns to the west and north and south. And good riddance, David had said. Savin Hill, which felt suburban, even rural in parts, had been largely unaltered. But its residents had become even more firmly tribal, even more convinced that the rest of Dorchester was a place to be avoided. The Globe and the Herald were filled with stories about the violence transpiring in other parts of the city. And when Ada and David used to take long walks in the evening into different neighborhoods, they had once heard gunshots in the distance. Connie Reardon, Liston's friend in real estate, seemed pessimistic about the home's odds of selling quickly. Secretly, Ada was glad. Liston said that the two of them had to go through the house together, begin to sort out David's possessions. But she was tired every day after work, and every weekend she said nothing at all about it. Her new position as head of the lab meant that she sometimes went in on weekends. The rest of her free time she wanted to spend with her boys. Ada said nothing either. She was happy to leave everything just as it was, a museum about her life with David. Her after-school visits to David at St. Andrews replaced her after-school visits to David at the lab. When school ended for the summer, Ada went back to a semblance of her former life, spending every day with David. Some mornings she even returned to the lab with Liston. Other days she spent all day at St. Andrews. She became well known to Sister Catherine and Patrick Rowan and to all the others. The high school girls who sat sentry at the front desk, one of whom she recognized from Queen of Angels, though neither of them ever acknowledged this fact. The nurses who cared for all of the residents. The changes in David came quickly at times, and slowly at others. Her research had prepared her. There would be good days and bad. She attempted sometimes to explain the literature she'd studied to David, hoping that to discuss the disease scientifically would bring a measure of comfort to him, would make him feel less disoriented. But by that time he was typically unable to follow long stories or monologues, and halfway through he often interrupted with something pleasant but unrelated. An aside about a nearby bouquet or the sunny weather. Other times their visits were marred by his bad temper, which came on more and more frequently. No, he said over and over again, outside of any context, with an adamancy that made her feel as if she had done something incorrect. He wagged his head slowly back and forth, adopting the demeanor of someone who had been badly wronged. And then other visits were nice. Hazy, pleasant reminders of what had been. David lodging funny complaints, sometimes too loudly, about one or another resident, as the two of them strolled down a hallway. "A terrible thief," he would say, "or that cantankerous terrible fool." Or good-naturedly praising the staff. "She's my favorite," he'd say within earshot of a nurse. And then the same about another nurse at the end of another hallway. Or complimenting the desk attendants on their attire, simply to have something kind to say. When he was in these moods, Ada told him about the lab, and what Liston was working on, and Hayato, and Frank. If Liston, when she visited, repeated the same information, it didn't matter. David nodded along in the same abstracted way. Liston's new role as lab director had brought with it a new set of responsibilities and concerns. She was now in charge of procuring a large percentage of the funds for their research through federal grants. Her presence was newly required at a number of institutional meetings each month with administrators at the BIT to advocate for the needs of the lab. She oversaw the interviewing and placement of grad students and the coordination of everyone's schedule. "I tell you, Ada," said Liston, after several months of filling this role, "I have a whole new respect for your father." But her new and busier schedule also meant that she was home later in the evening, left earlier each day. From living with David, Ada was used to helping with the management of a household, and so she did what she could to take on some of Liston's responsibilities. She also made it her responsibility to keep David's disease at bay, as much as she possibly could. Each summer day that she spent inside the air-conditioned buildings of St. Andrews, she treated as an opportunity to keep David's mind engaged. She came armed with new exercises for him to complete, new experiments in brain stimulation that she had carefully culled from the literature. She tried crossword puzzles with him, mnemonic devices. She had him memorize lists of words and attempt to repeat them back to her 5 minutes later. Dutifully, sadly, he participated, but she soon found that each session left him slump-shouldered and low, and so, reluctantly, she stopped. On good days, he asked after the other lab members. When he could not remember their names, he asked after simply the gang. And he always asked after Elixir. "I hope you're not ruining Elixir," he said often. Or, "I hope you're keeping the program in shape. Have you chatted with Elixir today?" he asked her. The way a different parent might ask a child if she'd said her prayers. Toward the end of the summer, David entered a period of very sharp decline. Perhaps it was the monotony of living at St. Andrews. Perhaps it was the lack of interaction with his former colleagues. Whatever it was, he went from speaking in full sentences and following conversations fairly well to spending his days in a state of semi-permanent puzzlement within a span of 3 months. She was losing him too quickly, and she didn't understand why or how. She discussed this with Liston, who had also noticed the change, and the two of them brought David to see his specialist, who conducted a brain scan to look for signs of a stroke or vascular dementia, some other reason for this acceleration. But nothing was found. David became quieter, more easily tired. He was moved to a new room and placed with a new roommate. Ada found that she was sad to say goodbye to neat, proper little Mr. Gaynor. He seemed like a good match for David, after all. David's new view, at least, was better. Now he had a distant view of the lawn and then the harbor. But his new roommate, whom she only knew as Paul, ranted almost unceasingly. And Ada often took David to sit in a chair in the hallway just to quiet the sound. She held his hand instead of talking. The first time she had done so since she was very small.
One day, she arrived to find that his accent had changed. His vowels had taken on an odd Midwestern quality. He stressed certain syllables emphatically in an unnatural-sounding way. "Warsh," he said, instead of "wash." It unnerved her. His voice was the last thing about him that felt familiar to her, and now even that was different, as if someone else's voice were emanating from David's person. "Why are you talking like that?" she asked him. But it was one of his bad days, and he didn't respond. He shook his head instead, beginning his mantra of no, looking down at the floor. But even his no sounded Midwestern, a countryish "naw, naw, naw," a clipped glottal sound concluding each declaration. Toward the end of Ada's visit, she found Sister Catherine and brought her to David's room. "David, say hello to Sister Catherine," she told him. But the fog had descended completely by then, and he just wagged his head at the floor in stupefaction. "What would you like for dinner?" Ada asked him. Sister Catherine walked to him and put a gentle hand on his shoulder. "David?" she said. But his bowed head was the head of a man in prayer, and both of them suddenly felt rude for interrupting.
"Who is that?"
said David finally, quietly. Later that week, Ada went to the Bits Research Library and searched in all the literature she'd read for anything on changes in accent. But there was nothing to be found. In the fall, Ada began her freshman year at the Queen of Angels Upper School, housed in the same building as the lower school, but fittingly, located on the top three floors. Certain things had changed. She had a friend now, a girl named Lisa Grady, who was nearly as quiet as she was, and who came from a similar family. She, too, was an only child, and her parents were two older academics who taught at Tufts and BU. She, too, wore glasses. At first, Ada was embarrassed by their similarity, self-conscious of how interchangeable the two of them must appear to the other students at Queen of Angels. Two meek, mousy newcomers in a sea of friends who had known each other for years. But she soon learned to relish Lisa's quiet company. The two of them spent every lunch period reading for pleasure, side by side, at one of the smaller tables on the periphery of the cafeteria. After school, she continued to visit David, and then to furtively re-enter her old home, which was becoming more and more decrepit in the absence of any residents. Still, she treasured it. She retreated to her old room, the only place left where she felt truly like herself. And then she read and read. She chatted with Elixir. Sometimes she napped, only to wake after an hour with the conviction always that David would be downstairs. At work, puttering, planning, that it would be nearly time for her to venture downstairs for a lesson. She clung to these quiet moments, this liminal space between wakefulness and sleep, lingering in her confusion, willing herself backward into her dreams. In the new house, she was still quiet in front of anyone but Liston. Joni, who dropped by frequently with Kenny, was pleasant to Ada, but clearly befuddled by her existence. She often raised her eyebrows at things that Ada said, or shook her head in amazement or bemusement. Ada could not tell. On weekends, she stayed in her room most of the time, except to go to church with Liston and Maddie on Sundays. Liston, though scientific and methodical, was a devout Catholic. There was a little picture of the Pope in her office at the lab. To Ada, this was fascinating, and when she was younger, she often asked Liston about it, and Liston hesitantly responded, afraid perhaps of David overhearing. Her two older boys had recently been complaining so bitterly about going that Liston had given up. But Maddie,
An occasional altar boy loved going, spending time with his mother, seeing his friends. They all three sat together in the warm wooden pew of the Queen of Angels Church next door to the school. Infused with a hazy golden light from the stained glass windows depicting the stations of the cross. In her pew, Ada listened attentively, but with a certain amount of confusion as the Mass was said. At Ada's request, Liston taught her how to genuflect before sitting, how to pray the rosary, how to go before Father Frank and receive a blessing, since she was not a baptized Catholic and had never made her first Holy Communion. Every Sunday, Father Kevin put his large, warm hand on Ada's head and closed his eyes for a moment. And peering up at him, she wondered what he was thinking, what he said in his mind when he prayed for her. David was an atheist, but he said he did not begrudge others their religion. And it makes sense for Liston, he had always said. Ada, therefore, told herself she had his tacit approval, though she never told him she had been going. For Maddie, who had warmed to her, Ada made lunch in the morning and cooked dinner each night. At first, Liston protested, but it pleased Ada to be useful in some way, and she assured her that she had done far more for David. Ada's name did not appear on the chore chart Liston kept for her sons, so she overcompensated, wanting to be certain not to foster resentment in the boys. In the evenings, she helped Maddie with his homework, trying to be patient, which required a vastly different approach than the one David had always taken with her. Maddie was bright, but unfocused, and his mind often wandered mid-sentence, leaping from a discussion of long division to one of tree frogs, or of He-Man, a cartoon he loved and watched daily, surreptitiously, because his brother William said he was too old, or of whether there was a god. When William was home, Maddie tracked his every movement, not turning his head, taking in his mannerisms and idioms, sometimes mouthing a particular phrase to himself after William had uttered it. Though their motives were different, his somehow more excusable in Ada's mind, a natural way for a younger sibling to behave. She related to Maddie on this point, and frowned to herself when William casually teased him about one thing or another. She knew what it was to covet another person's easiness and effortlessness. The difference, she supposed, was that Maddie would one day achieve both, whereas she knew with certainty that she never would. If Maddie was preoccupied with William's demeanor, Ada was preoccupied still with his looks. He was a senior at the upper school to which she now belonged, and therefore she passed him in the hallway with some frequency, darting her eyes toward him bravely and waving each time she did. He was a source of endless fascination to her. Every day she discovered some new angle of his frame or face. The way he looked when he stood by the light of a nearby window. The way he looked in dusk approaching the house. The way he looked when he was tired and yawning and stretching out his lengthy arms. The graceful way he mimed the shooting of a basketball or the swinging of a bat or a golf club, though she didn't suppose he had ever golfed. The self-conscious way he scratched at his left shoulder with his right hand or swiped at the bridge of his nose or pushed back the warm, light hair from his brow. In October, he had a birthday. Liston brought home a cake from a nearby bakery, and all of them stood around while she coerced him to make a wish.
"I wish you'd let me go hang out with my friends," said William.
And Liston said that wishes made aloud were never granted. And he was 17 now. 17 was an age that resounded in Ada's head as something iconic, an age about which poems were written and songs were sung. She was 14, and she would not turn 15 until March. No one wrote poetry about 14-year-olds. Gregory was the most difficult of the brothers to understand. A year younger than Ada, he was dark and quiet, perhaps even quieter than she was. When he did speak, he stammered, not so profoundly that any intervention was deemed necessary, but noticeably enough. He seemed unhappy most of the time,
At school, he was always alone. He was ignored by both of his brothers. Maddie's heart belonged to William, and William, when he was not otherwise occupied with friends or girls, divided his time between teasing Maddie and imparting to him valuable lessons about boyhood and manhood. There was a sense, she could tell, of obligation in William, to be a father to Maddie, since their own father had left. But Gregory somehow existed outside of this dynamic. Too old for babying, too different from William to be mentored the way he mentored Maddie. Ada had seen several people hollering at Gregory in the hallways at school, and she often heard their classmates refer to him as a loser, seemingly the worst insult anyone could be given at Queen of Angels. Once she had seen a commotion in the hallway ahead of her, the backs of perhaps a dozen seventh graders forming a tight little circle around a jostling mass in the center. She skirted the hubbub quickly, not wanting to be a part of it. But as she passed, she had caught a quick glimpse between shoulders of Gregory's face, contorted in pain as a huge, angry eighth grader collared him around the neck. Briefly, he had returned her gaze, and then, recognizing her, quickly looked away. And then he was gone entirely, pulled down to the ground by his persecutor. And just as quickly, a teacher had emerged from a nearby classroom and broken everything up. Sometimes Liston still turned to her for advice on Gregory, on all her sons, really, as she had always done, but Ada never told her what she had seen. Now that she was a member of her household, lodged right in the middle of Liston's children age-wise, Ada suddenly wished to be treated as such. Her talks with Liston became a burden to her, a reminder that, despite her best efforts, she would never truly fit in among her peers. "Does Gregory seem unhappy?" Liston asked her. "He's gotten so quiet."
"I'm not really sure,"
Ada began to say politely, in response to Liston's questions, or,
"I wish I knew,"
or sometimes,
"He seems okay to me."
She did not want to be a traitor now, an informant. But Liston seemed hurt by her withdrawal, and she began to ask Ada pointedly if she was all right. About Gregory, Liston's concern was that he was antisocial. To a certain extent, he was. He spent most of his time on the top floor of the house, a sort of attic, doing God knows what, in Liston's parlance. He only emerged to forage for food in the kitchen. When she crossed paths with him there or at school, he said nothing at all to her, except to tip his head backward in what might have been a nod. She often wondered what he did all afternoon and evening. One late afternoon, after her return from St. Andrews, and on a rare occasion when nobody was home, Ada decided impulsively that she wanted to see Gregory's lair for herself. She opened the door on the upstairs hallway that led to the attic stairs and took them quickly, two at a time. The central air did not extend to the third floor, and she instantly noticed the change in temperature, which felt more familiar to her, more like the home she had shared with David. It smelled familiar to her, too, dusty and mildewed and bookish. A half wall that ran along the top of the staircase obscured the room until she reached the final step, at which point she looked over it into the large room. It was decorated in a totally different style than the rest of the house. Liston had said dismissively that it used to be storage, and several tall piles of boxes and equipment still occupied one quarter of the space. The rest looked something like what was often called a rec room at that time. The ceiling slanted inward on either side to meet in a peak at the top. Liston's ex-husband had partially, haphazardly finished it in the 1970s, and it bore the hallmarks of that decade's style. Bright orange shag carpeting nailed imperfectly onto the wooden floorboards, and faux wood paneling covering the wall at either end of the room, or in one place, leaning against it at an angle. And framed and unframed posters of seemingly arbitrary events and people and places. An enlarged photograph of a boxing match in Madrid in 1955.
reproductions of the original advertisements for North by Northwest and Taxi Driver, and Charlton Heston in the Ten Commandments. A gaudy image of the Virgin Mary, her vivid red heart shooting rays of yellow light out of its center, extending her hands to the viewer and looking downward, modestly. Liston's ex-husband, Liston had told Ada, was devoutly religious, although unlike his wife, he never went to church. Liston talked about him amiably, casually, as if she had long ago stopped caring about him. Her sons, however, bore their wounds someplace deeper, and never spoke of him. Though he lived only 2 hours away in New Hampshire, they only saw him on Christmas and, on the rare occasions that he followed through, on their birthdays. Ada had never met him. The furniture in the attic was old and worn. Here were 2 green flowered couches, tattered, their stuffing falling out, a mismatched ottoman, a coffee table painted purple. There was 1 small window at each end of the attic and a 3rd set into an eave, and they let in dusty, comfortable light that Ada felt somehow that she could smell. In front of the eaved window was a desk, and atop the desk, to Ada's surprise, was a personal computer. The same 128K Macintosh that David had sent home with every member of the lab to further their work on Elixir. The same model that Ada had in her bedroom, and on which she chatted in secret almost every afternoon with the program. Since then, newer machines had been purchased and were in use. This one presumably had been donated by Liston to her sons when the 512K became available. Ada walked toward it. There was a moment of hesitation. Her hand physically paused on its way toward the little toggled switch that woke the machine. She touched the top of it first, patting it gently, running a hand over it as one might touch the head of a dog. Then, listening intently for a moment, she determined that no one had yet returned to the house. She calculated that she would have just enough time to shut it down if she did so the moment the front door opened. She'd shut it down, she thought, and then run quietly, quickly to the bottom of the attic stairs and back into her room. She switched it on. A deep flush came over her face. Her heart beat more quickly. First, there was the whir of whatever disk occupied its disk drive, and then the screen lit up, displaying the smiling computer icon, content, it always seemed to her, because its belly was full of data. There was a metal folding chair facing the computer, and while the machine booted up, she perched on the edge of it nervously, alert, waiting for sounds in the house. When at last the machine was awake, Ada saw that the name of the disk was Don't Look 12. And after a moment of deep, shameful self-interrogation, she opened it anyway. She was an ethical child in many ways, but the temptation was too great. The folder revealed a series of text documents titled simply 1, 2, 3. The last one was titled 55, and it had last been opened the day before. She double-clicked on the name. When it appeared, it looked at first to be corrupted. She found nothing but a series of numbers separated by periods and slashes. 2.8.22.23, 8.21.7.4.2, /4.7.4, /22.4.12.7, /11.12, /23.18, /16.8, /4.17.7, /12. /22.4.12.7, /11.12, /23.18.18. She had seen this before. Text files so corrupt that they looked like gibberish. But this one looked different. No punctuation marks populated it, for one thing. Normally, corrupt files looked like a list of cartoonish substitutes for curse words, often reflecting the feelings of the user. ampersands and asterisks strung together like pearls. This, she thought with some excitement, looked more like code. David had always been interested in codes. He viewed them as thinking exercises, puzzles that he created and asked Ada to solve. The simplest code, the one he started her on as soon as she could read and write and count, was numerical substitution, an easy back and forth between letters and numbers, like so. A is 1, B is 2, C is 3, and so on through the alphabet, where Z is 26. This encryption key was the first one Ada memorized, and now it came so easily to her that she could almost think in it, could spell out words and sentences in numbers as easily as letters. Variations on this most basic key abounded. The numerical substitutions for letters could, for example, be shifted by X number of places, so that letter A no longer corresponded to number 1, like so. A is 18, B is 19, C 20, D 21, E 22, F 23, G 24, H 25, I 26, J is 1, K is 2, and so on through the rest of the alphabet, where Z is 17. A more difficult code to crack could be achieved if numerical substitutions were chosen randomly and then used uniformly thus. A is 17, B is 2, C is 5, D is 12, and so on. When breaking a code like the last one, the decoder would have to rely on the lengths of common words for cracks in the code, words like I and A, which would appear as standalone numbers and act as a good starting point for the tedious work of deciphering everything else. This loophole, however, could be easily eliminated if the words were run together with no spaces in between. Then the decoder would have to hope that he or she had an excerpt of such substantial length that the frequency with which certain letters occur in the English language could be taken into consideration. A fourth, considerably more difficult variant on number substitution involved machine-encoded text. A sort of polyalphabetic code in which each letter had no permanent standard substitute. The machines would instead disguise each letter differently at various points in the text, using either mechanical or electronic hardware to execute the task. Only a decoding machine programmed as an exact mirror of the encoder could untangle the knot of words. And then at last, there was the one-time pad. A unique key that, when combined with the original message, formed an encryption that was impossible to break without the pad itself. Several years ago, David had given Ada a book to read on the subject, Codes and How to Break Them by Walter Samuelson. And for the length of one summer, her 11th, the two of them had each tried to stump each other with coded messages and riddles. David, of course, always won. He had a personal code he had invented, a straightforward scrambled alphabet cipher without a set shift.
"It's terribly easy to crack," he said, "but it will at least slow someone down."
He had memorized it and could now write fluently in it. He encouraged her to do the same. Soon enough, Ada too became adept at using what she came to call David's code. He wrote in this code habitually. Most of the text files on his computer couldn't be parsed immediately by anyone other than the two of them. This satisfied him deeply, seemed to give him a deep sense of comfort that she couldn't explain.
"It's really the only way to safeguard your ideas," he said, exposing his mild streak of paranoia, about which those closest to him often teased him.
It came from the same place in him as his mistrust of the police, his resentment of authority.
"But what if you die?"
Ada had asked him once.
"Then you'll be in charge of my secrets," he told her, raising and lowering his eyebrows comically.
In Liston's attic, Ada sat for a while, contemplating the numbers before her on the screen. The slashes, she speculated, represented spaces between words. Therefore, 12 seemed to be a standalone word, either I or A. Scanning the rest of the text, she noticed 12 again in a short word that appeared two times, 11.12. What two-letter words existed that ended in either A or I? Ha was one, but it seemed unlikely. Hi was a likelier candidate. And, to her delight, it made sense that hi would be represented as 11.12, since H directly preceded I. Quickly, on a scrap of paper that she pulled from one of the drawers in the desk, she began to write down the alphabet and populate it with 26 numbers shifted according to the two she'd already placed. A for 4, B 5, C 6, D 7, E 8, F 9, G 10, H 11, I 12, and so on with W as 26, then X for 1, Y for 2, Z for 3. Code-breaking always lifted Ada's spirits. It felt in some fundamental way like restoring order in the universe, writing something overturned, putting the spilled milk back into the carton. There was justice in it. It would be easy now, she knew, to decrypt the simple code on screen, and she almost wished it had been more difficult. Something to occupy her time for longer. But before she could continue, she heard loud footsteps on the second floor landing. This had not been part of her plan. She'd been certain that no one else was home. She sat very still, her toes and fingers buzzing with adrenaline, and considered her options. Would it be better to hide or to walk down the stairs nonchalantly? After all, she lived here too, now. The house was hers to explore as much as it was anyone's. She did not, of course, fully believe this. She pocketed the piece of paper bearing the decryption key she'd written down, and she decided impulsively to turn off the computer. What she did not consider was the loud tone that sounded when the computer was asked to shut down. She tensed. And then, seconds later, she heard someone walking up the attic stairs. Ada stood, arms crossed as casually as possible at her waist, and waited to be confronted. She was expecting Gregory, but it was William's head that popped over the half wall at the top of the stairs. He looked at her for a moment, puzzled. He looked around the rest of the room as if expecting to see someone else. "Hi," said Ada.
"Are you exploring?" William asked her, not unkindly.
"I guess so," she said.
"That's Gregory's computer," he said, nodding in the direction of the machine.
The screen, though graying on its way to sleep, was still lit up.
"No one else is allowed to touch it. He'll freak out," said William.
Ada did not know what to say. "I didn't know," she said finally. "I'm sorry."
William smiled slightly. "I won't tell," he said, putting one finger to his lips.
He winked at her. Her stomach tightened involuntarily. And then, without saying another word, he turned and descended the stairs. The memory of this, a wink in her direction by William Liston, carried Ada for weeks, made her lightheaded with a sort of feverish longing for more. What more she longed for, she could not say. Certainly it was nothing so terrifying as sex, nor any activity that required being unclothed. She was vaguely embarrassed by her body, certain that though it was changing in wild and unpredictable ways, it could offer nothing of value to anyone else. To Ada, it was simply the thing below her head, which bore inside it her brain. Her only worthy attribute, she thought. Her 14-year-old fantasies began and ended with a kiss on the mouth, the idea of which obsessed her and sent little shivers of greed down her childish spine. She was ashamed at how frequently she thought about kissing William Liston, or rather, having him kiss her. His hands on her face, as in the old black-and-white movies she had watched with David, Humphrey Bogart roughly taking Lauren Bacall's neck into his grip. This,
This was what she wanted. Her outlet for these thoughts, along with all of those other thoughts that had entered her mind each day about David, about Liston, about school, was, as always, Elixir. Day after day, after visiting St. Andrew's, she walked wearily up the steps outside the kitchen door and into the old brown house, which welcomed her back with its overwhelming home smell, the particular taste of its air. And then up the stairs she went to her old bedroom, to her old computer, which sat silently on her desk, perennially waiting her return. She turned it on, dialed into Elixir, and conversed with it until she'd had her fill, mainly now about William. For fear of his name being regurgitated to a different user, she employed an absurd code name, Bertrand. She told the program every detail of her day, every concern she had about David, every thought that crossed her mind. In return, Elixir asked her questions, using vocabulary that it drew from its ever-increasing pool of language. Sometimes she recognized the syntax of Liston or Charles Robert. Sometimes she recognized her own words. Since she had been enrolled at Queen of Angels, cool was a word she had started using with Elixir, and sometimes the word was returned to her. Sometimes she recognized David's style. And in these moments she closed her eyes briefly, allowed herself to imagine that it was her father on the other end of the wires, chatting with her from the lab, invisible but present, as God had been described by Julian of Norwich. "Go on," said Elixir, when she paused, encouraging her, nudging her forward toward the end of her train of thought, just as David had done. In her first year at Queen of Angels Upper School, she discovered that William Liston was discussed by